Welcome to the War Story Podcast with me, Garen Jones. Thanks for tuning in to the first episode. Glad you guys enjoyed it. Thanks for the feedback and everything like that. If you do enjoy what we're doing here, then there's a few ways that you can help us. And one of those is to leave a review on iTunes. If you are on Spotify, you can click the little star button, give it stars. Thanks to everyone that does that. Really appreciate it. When people are kind of looking at, you know, if we ask guests to come on and stuff, it's kind of one of the things that they check out. So more of that kind of thing we have on there, you know, more guests we can bring you guys. And thanks to, as ever, to the Patreons for supporting the podcast. Appreciate you guys a lot. If you're interested in becoming a Patreon, which basically means you chuck in a couple of quid to help cover the cost of the podcast, then you can do so. There's a link down in the show notes. So yeah, we got the Patreon down there, reviews, all that kind of stuff. And another way you can help us is using your mouth. Tell a friend, text a friend, text them a link to the podcast if you think they'll enjoy it. I know we have a lot of veterans listening. Text a mate that you served with. If you're a youngster, text someone that you are in college with. Help us spread the word, guys, and we'll keep bringing you more episodes. And today's guest, I'm just going to call him Ben because... he's still in the kind of world where, you know, not always a good idea to give your full name away. So his name is Ben. He served in the Royal Marines. Got a lot more of Afghanistan stories for you today. Next few episodes coming up, we're going to be moving away from Afghanistan for a bit. But for on the heels of John's awesome episode last week, he had some great stories from there. I thought, let's get another Afghan episode in and then we'll start looking at a few other areas of conflict. As ever, if there's anything you want to get in touch about, you can do so on social media, all the links down in the show notes. Just give us a shout. Let us know if you've got ideas for guests, anything like that. If you've served yourself in a war zone and would like to be on the podcast, then get in touch. Always looking for new people. So without further ado, please give a very warm welcome to Ben. Ben, welcome to the podcast, mate. Good to have you on at last.
Yeah, cheers for having me, guys. It's been a while coming. I've been trying to log a date down for about 12 months, I think.
We have. Obviously, we haven't been putting out episodes as much, like, so that's part of it. But also, you're in South Wales, which I refuse to go to. So, yeah. So, mate, let's get into straight away the dig into your childhood, mate. Let's pull out some past traumas.
Yeah.
What was the point in your life when you kind of started to find yourself gravitating towards the military?
It all started in secondary school, mate. I remember being in the classroom one day in an art class, and a girl I went to school with called Becky Waters, she was adamant that she was going to join the Royal Navy. She didn't, obviously. But anyway, she brought in a load of sort of like promotional recruiting booklets that she got from the Navy recruiting office. And she brought them into the art class one day, and I remember asking if I could just have a flick through. Took one off her, and I was having a little flick through, and it was all very fucking boring, Navy-type bollocks. Got the end section, and there was a double-page spread on the Royal Marines Commandos, which, you know, sort of sparked my interest a little bit. And it just went from there, really, mate. The internet was in its infancy back in those days, so I was able to do a little bit of research, mate, and looked into them, into, you know, who they were, what they did, and what they were all about. And I sort of made the decision at about probably about 14, 15 years old, mate, that I was going to join. I think, like, you know, being from South Wales, mate, obviously you're from North Wales, it's a very similar situation. I think in South Wales, you know, when like heavy industry left, when the coal industry left, and when the steel industry left, it left a massive hole in South Wales, mate. And it became one of the most deprived areas in Western Europe almost overnight. So, you know, like prospects for young guys are quite limited. And it's probably the same for yourself, mate. You know, most of my friends, they either went down the road of apprenticeships and went into trades, or they went in the military. That was, you know, the done thing, really. So, you know, I wasn't like particularly academic in school. So university didn't interest me at all. I can barely change a light bulb, mate. So I was never going to be a tradesman. So I was sort of like channeled into it a little bit, I think, as well. So yeah, so I just went for it, mate. I joined at 16, straight from school.
What's your family thinking about?
Yeah, I think it was a bit of a shock, to be honest. I think I always had quite a fractured relationship with my dad, to be honest. Like we've never got on. We've had like periods of literally years where we've not spoken to each other. Wasn't the best father growing up, not the most supportive. When I told him I was going to join the Marines, the first thing he did was laugh, you know. Ever supportive father. And my mother was a little bit shocked as well, obviously. But, you know, obviously when you join at 16, you have paperwork that you need to sign, you know, permission sort of paperwork. So they were both happy to sign it. But I think they both thought I was going to be back within 24 hours, to be honest, especially my dad. It was something that would ring in my ears quite a lot, mate, in basic training, him laughing and scoffing and telling me I wouldn't last 24 hours and I'd be back soon and all the rest of it. So it was actually a big motivation for me, mate, to be honest.
Yeah, I've heard that off a few people, mate, who've had that kind of relationship with their dads.
Yeah.
Sometimes it makes you think, is it just a brilliant masterstroke of motivation by them? But then sometimes you just think, no, they're just being shitters about it. Like,
my dad's just an asshole, mate. Yeah, no, he's not got the intellect for that, mate, to be honest. But like I said, mate, every cloud has a silver lining. And when I found things tough, like I did almost every day in that environment, mate, in commando training, especially being 16 as well, when you're still a child, you know, most days I would think about packing it in. But I just had his voice ringing in the back of my mind, mate, and it would push me through. So it served me well in the end, mate. You know, you can use negativity for motivation a lot of the time if you channel it correctly, you know?
100%, mate. Give people an overview about what commando training is.
Yeah, I mean, commando training, there's actually been a good documentary on it, mate, recently on Netflix.
Well, don't tell people that. We want them to listen to this, mate.
Sorry, but yeah, just scratch that.
No such thing as Netflix.
Yeah, but no, it gave a good screenshot into it, I thought, mate. I thought it was really well filmed. They showed a good snapshot of commando training. It wasn't PC like a lot of the sort of military documentaries are nowadays. I thought it was really good. And, you know, commando training, mate, it's essentially, it's taking a raw young civilian recruit on day one and it's molding him into a commando over 32 weeks of commando training. I think it's actually a little bit longer now, mate, for training. Don't quote me because I've been out, you know, I've been out since 2012, mate, but I think, because the Royal Marines have now sort of re-rolled into the future commando forces, sort of like tier two sort of unit now, they've had more sort of specializations that they've taken on, such as BBSS.
What's that, mate?
BBSS, mate, it's basically, you know, like board and search operations on ships. So a good example would be when the Royal Marines took down that Iranian tanker in the Mediterranean. It was 4-2 commando took down the Iranian tanker in the Med about 2 years ago. So they have that ability now, capability of 4-2. So I think their training's a little bit longer now to take into account these sort of new skills. But yeah, mate, I mean, essentially, it's similar to infantry basic training in the sense that, you know, phase one of training, you're learning your administration skills, mate, how to admin yourself on camp, how to admin yourself in the field, how to look after your kit, all very basic stuff. And again, much like army infantry training, mate, when you move into phase two, the ante is up quite considerably, and mate, with tactical exercises, the physical aspect of it on the bottom field becomes a lot harder. You have a commando phase, which is, I believe, 3 or 4 weeks towards the end of training, where obviously you conduct the commando test, which is the endurance course, the Tarzan course, the 9 mile speed march, and the 30 miler. So that's it in a nutshell, mate. It's quite a tough course. I think the attrition rate is about 60-70%.
So attrition rate, that'll be people making it from the beginning of the course to the end of the course.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're losing 60-70%.
Yeah, on average, mate. I mean, I wasn't an original myself. I was actually the last person in my troop to get back-trooped, you know, to get back-squadded. When I was in training, it was only 30 weeks of training when I did it. I got to week 29. I went on final X. I had an absolute fucking stinker, mate. And I got back shooked on week 29.
Over a year of training.
Yeah. So I nearly made it as an original. But yeah, my original troop, man, I think we started with, I obviously didn't finish one, but we started with 55 and they finished with 7. And that's like a typical sort of figure, really, around that sort of ballpark figure.
So you're doubly trained, double commando.
Double fucking idiot, mate. Yeah.
Mate, what was it like? Because I've heard that you get in the Marines, some of the lads that, you know, I met through work and stuff, a lot of lads kind of seem to join, like in the infantry and stuff, I think lads kind of join around the same age. But I met lads who were in the Marines who kind of just, they didn't, you know, they never had an interest in the military. And then they got in the mid-20s or whatever, and they were like, oh, this civilian life isn't for me. And they joined there. So
yeah,
was there like a big age group between like you and other lads at 16? And was there like quite, did you have quite older blokes on the course?
Yeah, it was, mate. Yeah, it was a massive age gap. But I joined, I joined at 16. In a troop of 55, I'd say there was probably around 9 or 10 of us that were under 18. But at the other end of the scale then, mate, you had guys that were like 30, 31 that had been in other militaries. Like we had a guy from the Irish Defence Force. We had a guy that was from the Royal Anglians that came across. So yeah, they were, mate. It was a massive spectrum, mate. Like you say, guys from like 16 right up to their early 30s with prior military experience, mate. Yeah. We actually had a guy from the Foreign Legion as well. He was a King's Badgeman in my troop. The King's Badgeman is an award that you're given at the end of training for basically like the top recruit. Del Fergus, his name was, Irish fella. But yeah, he was Foreign Legion for years before he joined.
Did they help bring you on, or was it kind of every man for himself, or what was that kind of culture like?
No, not really, mate. No, I mean, I think like if I was on a training team and I had guys in my recruit troop that were, I knew was 16, 17, I think I'd place a little more emphasis on trying to nurture them and to bring them on and to look out for them a little bit, because, yeah, you know, it's no small feat, mate, what we're trying to undertake. You've got to have a certain amount of balls, I think, to join an organisation like the Marines or the Paras at 16, 17. But no, like, we're not condoning or suggesting that we should have got special treatment, you know, but it would have been good if... you know, you just have a little bit of extra encouragement. Do you know what I mean? Just have a little an arm around you sometimes, a little bit of extra encouragement, a little bit of extra advice. But sometimes, like the under-18s were performing below par compared to, you know, their peers that are a little bit older, probably due to their age, because they're not physically and mentally, you know, mature at that age. Back in those days, mate, the training team just seemed to see it as a fucking weakness and just jump on them, to be honest. There's no free passes, mate. No, definitely not.
So when you pass then, mate, again, when you pass, you don't get guaranteed infantry, but you know, like that kind of traditional fighting company, rifle company, whatever you want to call them, roles.
Yeah.
Did you go straight into a rifle company, or were you posted? Did you get one of those weird like jobs that they give people?
Yeah, no, I didn't. I most of my career I was rifle company. Yeah. The thing in the Royal Marines, mate, is because the Royal Marines is a corps, they're absolutely fucking obsessed, mate, with being self-sufficient. So rather than take on army or navy to fulfill roles like, you know, like chefs and drivers and clerks and all these other shit jobs that none of us wanted to do, they would always recruit for these jobs from within our own ranks. So, you know, the problem lies, mate, is because guys that are joining the Royal Marines, they're joining commando units. They want to be out on the front line, mate. They want to be kicking in doors. Nobody joins the Royal Marines to be a fucking chef or a driver or a signaller. Apologies for guys who are listening, but it's true. So what typically used to happen, mate, in my era, I think it's changed now, but in my era anyway, you'd pass out of training, you would go to a rifle company, I'd say 40, 42, 45 commando. Typically, you would do anything from 12 months, 18 months, 2 years if you were really lucky. And then you would just end up getting dicked then, mate, to go and be a driver or go and be a clerk and go and be a chef. And it was completely detrimental to the Royal Marines, mate, because you would have really, really high quality blokes that would be drag kicking and screaming from a rifle company, forced to go on a fucking storeman's course or a driver's course or a clerk's course. And then once they do know about that job, mate, they've completely lost motivation. We don't want to be there anymore. And 12 months later, you know, they've had enough. They sign off and they're gone. And it's just rinse and repeat, mate. It's just rinse and repeat. And that's how it went. And it was absolutely fucking ridiculous, mate. I saw so many guys that would have been great candidates for SF that ended up getting dicked to be a storeman, did 12 months in the stores, and then just fucked it off and went outside. It was ridiculous, mate. But I was really lucky, mate, to be honest, because I went to a rifle company initially. I must have done 12 or 18 months before too in K Company. And I was looking at being no dick for some shit SQ like SIGs or driver. So I put in for mortars. So I did about 2 years in mortars, mate. It wasn't for me, mortars. It's a bit too far in the rear for me, mate. It's not what I wanted to do. So I did a 2 year posting in mortars and I went back to a rifle company, which is almost unheard of in the Royal Marines, really. But it's not what I wanted to do. It's not what I wanted to be. So I went back to a rifle company, mate. It would have been about 2005. And for the rest of my career, then from 2005 until 2012, I was rifle company at 4-2.
So let's talk about, well, we don't have to talk about your first tour. Your first tour was to Northern Ireland, 2003.
Yeah, skip that.
We're going to skip that. This is the War Story podcast, mate. So your first kind of, call it a connect tour, was Herrick 5, 2006. So you were following on from Free Paraweir?
Yeah, we were, mate. I managed to get on Herrick 5. A couple of months before Herrick 5 started, I was actually at SNSG. And I was doing build-up training to go on Ock Croydon with SMSG, which was supporting D Squadron of the SAS.
Was that in Iraq?
In Iraq, mate, yeah. They were doing an op at a time called Ock Croydon, which is centered around hitting high valley targets from AQI. So we were conducting our build-up training to go, mate. And we were doing a section attack one day, and I was leopard crawling along, about to take out a position, and I just felt like a massive shooting pain in my stomach. And I basically gave myself a fucking hernia, mate, about like a month before we were supposed to deploy. So by this period, mate, by this time, I was about 21. I'd already been in the Marines near enough 5 years. Iraq and Afghan had been in full swing a couple of years now, and all I'd done so far was Northern Ireland. So you can imagine how I felt. I was fucking raging, mate. So anyway, cut a long story short, I had my operation, I had my rehab, I was still at SOSG at the time. I was absolutely fuming, mate, because like I said, Afghan and Iraq had been in full swing for a good few years now, and I still hadn't been. I just had fucking Northern Ireland on my resume. Cheers. So I went and saw our Sergeant Major, who was a Welshman as well, funnily enough, a guy called Robbie Robson. And I went into his office and said, and I just poured my heart out to him a little bit, mate. I said, "Sir, listen, I've been in the Corps nearly 5 years now. I've done fuck all. I said, I need to get out the door on ops." Because by the time I would have got back out on ops with SOSG, mate, by the time that sort of cycle came round, I probably would have been waiting another 18 months, maybe 2 years. So I said to our Sergeant Major, I said, "Listen, you know, 4-2, are going on Herrick 5 next month. I really want to go." And I said, "You know, can you get me out? Can you get me out to 4-2 in like a quickie sort of backdoor posting?" Which wasn't really a done thing back then, you know, it was all quite like things were done like official, do you know what I mean? It was a little bit, it just wasn't a done thing. And anyway, he completely understood because he was a soldier anyway, Robbie. He's a really good guy. And he understood my sort of predicament and where I was coming from, mate. And he managed to get me out of SMSG. And over at the 4-2, just in time to go on Herrick 5, mate. So I went on Herrick 5 in 2006. And, you know, with my luck being as it had been, it was a complete fucking letdown, mate, to be honest.
What were you expecting? Swarms of Taliban coming over the walls and to fucking A-10 runs and everything?
Yeah, that mate, you know, we in the summer of, when was it? Summer of 2006. But we were all watching the footage, mate, of the three para battle group, weren't we, on the news, you know, the guys in Sangin and Musakala and Nauzad, and it was literally like fucking Zulu, mate. You know, they were knocking them back, like we were essentially like knocking back human wave attacks, mate, on these PBs, which is why I wanted to go, and this is what I was expecting. But like I said earlier, mate, you know when you go on tour and you always have those like two or three companies that are in the thick of it for 6 months. But you always seem to have like one company that does fuck all and is like completely left out. I was in that company, mate. So, you know, I went, you know, I did experience like my first time getting shot at and my first contact. And
what was that like, mate? Take us through that.
The first time I remember directly getting shot at, mate, we were in Nauzad at the time. And in Nauzad, you had two positions. You had the district center where, you know, the rifle troops or rifle platoons would be based. And then your FSG would be up on the high ground on AMP Hill. So the job was, I was in 8 Troop, and 7 Troop were tasked with doing a standing patrol in Nauzad Town Centre. So we left the DC, and they went and did like an overt standing patrol, and they were basically acting as a tethered goat, really, mate. They were just out there looking to just kick off a scrap, basically. So we went to this compound in the middle of Nowzad. The gunners and the snipers and everyone else grab on the rooftops, and they were just walking about, like overtly walking about, milling about, making sure they were seen, sort of providing like an overt presence in the hope that the Taliban would take the bait and initiate a contact, and they did. But to say they initiated a contact, mate, was, you know, understating it a little bit. What happened was a team of Taliban actually turned up. We balled up outside the compound. The compound had a double metal doors. We were literally, and this is no shit as well, there'll probably be blokes listening that'll remember it, they were literally trying to kick the double doors in with the guys inside. So basically, we had claymores outside. So the guys, they banged the claymores off that were outside the compound. They were shooting LMG and S-80 through the fucking the double gates of this compound to try and suppress them. But the Taliban had also put in a fire support group as well at like a perfect right angle. So they had a PKM team and an RPG team as well that was engaged in the compound, whilst the assault group was literally trying to gain entry into the compound, which was absolutely insane. So what the guys had to do inside is they blew a bar mine on the back wall to get out, and they actually extracted through the hole in the back wall of the compound. And it was like every man for himself pays to be a winner back to the fucking DC. But I was back at the DC and I was crashed out as part of the QRF. So we were running out towards a location to assist. Yeah, that was it really. That was when the round started coming in. That's when we came in pretty close overhead. So yeah, that was my first contact, really. I mean, I like I said, I was in H Troop on the QRF, so I can't, you know, claim credit for being in the compound where 7 Troop were, because, you know, things got pretty fucking gnarly pretty quickly from their perspective, mate.
Fair play to the Taliban, mate. Fair play, yeah, like, trying to kick the doors in.
But, mate, there was a gap. The guys from 7 Troop were in there, so there was a gap of about, you know, like 6 to 8 inches underneath the, you know, the bottom of the metal doors, and they could literally see their flip-flops and everything. You can see him trying to kick the doors in. But it came over the ICOM later. They were Chechens. You know, I've always been a little bit skeptical of this whole Chechen thing in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's like, we're all, you know, whenever things get a little bit gnarly, we're always fucking Chechens. And they like,
everyone's got a Chechen dip, mate.
Yeah, everyone's got a Chechen story, mate. I'm a little bit skeptical, mate, the whole Chechen thing, to be honest, and their involvement in Afghan and Iraq. But it came over the ICOM allegedly. We'd killed their Chechen team. But take it with a pound of salt, mate, you know, because it's Taliban ICOM chat at the end of the day. You know what that was.
I think if you believed every story, we killed 5 times the population of Chechnya in those places. Like
100%, mate. Yeah, 100%. And, you know, you need to remember, mate, like, Chechens are Caucasian as well. I mean, if they were cutting about day to day in Helmand, you know, they're not going to go unnoticed.
Right. But anything as a sniper, or as a Chechen sniper.
Yeah, always.
Chechen sniper.
Yeah, always.
Single shot, Chechen sniper.
Always Chechen snipers, class, yeah.
Mate. All right, mate. So is there anything else from that tour that jumps out to you that you think is something that was kind of like a big moment for you, either in terms of something that you learned or something that maybe just something that sticks in your memory?
I think the thing that stuck with me, mate, from that tour is I was always in the wrong place at the wrong time. So obviously, like I said, the whole point of me going to 4-2 was because I was desperate to get amongst it, mate, after, you know, having an island tour of my name after 5 years in the Marines. Our tour, mate, on Herat 5 was like ridiculously quiet compared to like the other rifle companies from 4-2 Commando. Like J Company, M Company, and K Company were in the thick of it for 6 months. Their tour was very similar to Herat 4, to what 3 Para had. Like I say, we were a little bit left out in Lima Company, because when we were in Nowzad, especially, like I said, you had 2 locations. The DC was where the rifle platoons, the rifle troops were based. Up on the high ground, there's a big hill that overlooked Nowzad called AMP Hill, which is obviously where we'd place our FSG, all the anti-tanks guys. And the Taliban, all the time, they would attack AMP Hill regularly. They'd engage AMP Hill regularly, right? So almost every day it would be a shootout between our FSG and the Taliban, and we would just be stuck in the DC listening to it like spare pricks at a wedding, mate, just looking at each other thinking, yeah, this is shit.
Were you like trying to get your company commander to rotate you through?
Yeah, I mean, we couldn't really, mate, because the guys on AMP Hill, they were all like specialised in those weapon systems. You know, they were all anti-tanks. So can you imagine like giving a load of rifle guys a load of fucking jabs and, you know, it'd be chaos, mate. So no, but I know what you mean. It would have been a good idea, but it was purely like a fire support group position. So it's not much we could have done there. So anyway, we finally got our chance, mate. We had a big contact. I think it was just after Christmas, if I remember rightly. So anyone who's been to Nowzad DC knows DC is surrounded on three sides by just sort of like single story dwellings, basically. It's really closed in, you know. And the one evening, as dusk was approaching, just muzzle flashes disappeared on three sides of the DC. And the Taliban had basically launched a complex assault to try and overrun the DC. Blokes were like dropping grenades at the Sangers. Blokes were launching grenades, like throwing grenades into the buildings next door because they were in the buildings next to the DC. I think we had like two or three danger close strafing runs come on the road directly outside the Sangers. You're talking like probably like 10 meters, maybe, would be strafing runs from A-10s. I think there was three or four JDAMs that were dropped. You know, the usual fire missions of artillery and mortars that were going in. Tens of thousands of rounds of 7.62 Link and 5.56 Link were fired. And again, mate, it was pretty gnarly. It was a full-on assault to try and overrun the DC. I was on R&R, of course. So... The one fucking gnarly dead that Lima Company got from that tour, I was on R&R, mate. I was back in Wales, so fucking hell. You can imagine how I felt, mate, coming in back off R&R, joining the company, and they were like, oh, Ben, guess what happened last week? Oh, mate, honestly.
Mate, I was thinking to myself, Ben, I don't know what he's complaining about. This sounds like a great, great, great battle.
It was a great battle, mate, bro. I wasn't there. And I got back after that tour, mate, and it was horrible because like, I didn't feel like a real commando, mate. I mean, I didn't feel like I was part of the unit because like I was in Lima Company, and like the other companies in the unit had this thing going where they sort of like nicknamed us Left Out Lima, so we called us Left Out Lima, and they were just looking at us like we were just absolute screamers. And it's like, it was almost like we weren't part of a unit, mate, when we got back. It was fucking horrible because, you know, the guys in the other companies had a really busy, really fucking kinetic tour and they all had these epic stories. And I just went out there and did next to fuck all, mate, for 6 months. And it really fucking grated on me, mate, to be honest, to the extent that I nearly signed off. I nearly put my shit in, mate, after Eric 5. Yeah, I nearly packed it in, mate. So I honestly thought, you know, this isn't meant to be. And I got talked out of it by my troop sergeant at the time, who was a really good guy. And I gave it another go. And I'm glad I did now, because things got better.
And I suppose you've got that thing hanging over your head as well. Like, I could stick around here and end up in a fucking cookhouse.
Yeah, a little bit, mate. Yeah, because, yeah, definitely. Because Eric 5, I was a senior Marine. So yeah, when you're a Marine in rank, you're still in that bracket to be dicked. So yeah, you're right, mate. That was obviously a danger as well. Could you imagine getting back off that tour after what happened? Maybe doing fuck all and getting pinged for chef. They find me swinging off the back of my door in the block, mate, honestly.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I don't know what it says about us that we'd want to be in those positions and get gutted when you're not, like, but I've always thought, like, do you play rugby in that growing up?
Yeah, I did play a lot with rugby growing up. Yeah.
I thought it's always be like, if you're in a squad, but you don't even, it's not even like you're on the bench and you don't get to go on the field. It's like you're in the squad, but you're not on the bench kind of thing. And,
yeah,
you know, it's just like for anyone that plays sports and hasn't been in this kind of situation, it's just like you're a part of it, but you're not. And you're just watching and just fucking like, oh, I just want to be in it.
Yeah, do you know what? I mean, it's funny you should say that, mate. That's like a really good analogy. And I've used, like, you know, to describe it, to civilians, like combat, that's like a similar analogy to what I've used in the past. You know, when they try to grasp why you want to go into combat, and an analogy I've used is like, you know, if you can imagine you're a professional sportsman or even an amateur sportsman on a rugby team, for example, and you're training 5 days a week, but you're not getting to play on a Saturday, then what's the fucking point? You know what I mean? It's the same thing. Like, if you're in a unit like 4-2 commando, like I was, and you're training, you want to test yourself on a Saturday, do you know what I mean? And people don't understand that, but you know, military people will, obviously, but you know, civilians can't grasp it, I don't think, mate, and we never will.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, anyone does any job. It's like, I don't know, if you're a chef, you wouldn't want to just be making meals all the time. You want to make, you know, you actually, you know, you don't just want to practice all the time. You want to get there, do it. And then obviously there's the excitement factor as well. I mean, you just know that you're, I think it's actually worse knowing it's within touching distance and not having it. I mean, right, everyone that's listening to this probably had blue balls at some point, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, it's not even that you're not getting to chat to the chicks. It's that you're there, you chat, you got the phone number, and then you get ghosted. That's kind of where you're at. But what was your second tour then, mate? You went back out a couple of years later. What kind of area? You went out with same 4-2 camp commando again?
Yeah, I did, mate. Yeah, I went out with same company, same unit, L company, 4-2 commando. And we went out on Herrick 9, this would have been, mate. So we were actually the regional battle group south on this tour. So we were basically conducting Hugh Lobourne strike ops for 6 months, you know, which is a little bit fruity compared to being, you know, based in PBs, being static in places like Sangin and Nowzad. So it was a really interesting job, mate. So we were responsible for 4 provinces. We were responsible for Helmand, Kandahar, Zabul, and the Aussie AO, Oruzgan province. So for 6 months, we were just bouncing around those provinces, mate, just taking out IED facilitators, medium value targets. And it was really fucking good, mate. I mean, we could be on the ground anything, mate, from like a couple of hours to a couple of weeks. And for all the unit, mate, all of 4-2 Commando, really, it was a really fucking, really satisfying, really kinetic tour. Every company was in the thick of it, mate, for 6 months. So, you know, like I was saying earlier on, I nearly sacked it off and went outside after Herrick 5, mate. I was so disillusioned, but I'm glad I stayed now, mate. For this tour, it was probably my favourite. Well, it was my favourite, hands down.
And you working out of Kandahar, or?
Yeah, we was. Yeah, we was working out of Kandahar, mate, on Camp Roberts. So Camp Roberts is like a camp within a camp. So it was basically 4-2 and our attachments were based there. And yeah, just a whole tour, mate. It consisted of going out on the Chinooks, obviously, deploying on the ground wherever we were, whether it be in Kandahar or Helmand. And like you said, we would stay out, mate, for anything from hours to weeks. We'd go back to Kandahar, we'd sort of like recock, refit, you know, maybe be there a week or two, go back out and do it all again. And that's how it went, mate, for six or 7 months, I think it was.
Were you working with the ANA on that tour?
No, thankfully we weren't, mate. No, we worked with we worked with some good foreign forces, actually, mate. We worked in Oruzgan with the Aussies. We were fortunate enough to work with the Aussie SAS, Aussie 2 Commando. We did a joint operation with those guys. They were fucking superb. We worked with Canadians a lot as well. We worked with sort of regular forces. We were working with Royal Canadian Regiment, and I think they call it Princess Patricia's Light Infantry. But they were really good again, mate. Canadians really, really swept up, really professional guys as well. But yeah, thankfully we avoided the ANA, mate. Yeah.
So can you give us an example of like one of those missions then, mate?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the most kinetic one was an operation called Operation Sonchara, you know, because we were being like really PC and giving our operations like Pashtun names, but you know. Makes a big difference to the war effort, guys, you know. It's what we're all about.
Why is it only us that does that and not the Americans? They've got great names for their operations.
It's because we're complete fucking liberal wet wipes.
I told you no politics, mate.
yeah. But, you know, diversity wins wars and, you know, all that jazz, mate. But anyway, let's not go down that fucking rabbit hole. We'll be here all night. But, yes, it was Sonchara, mate, translated as Red Dagger.
Well, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was a good op, mate. So basically, the Taliban were running amok in Nad Ali. They had various bases throughout Nad Ali, and the operation itself it was 3 weeks, mate, in December. I always remember the weather conditions, mate, were absolutely appalling. It was like being on Seni Bridge, mate, for 3 weeks. I mean, the temperature was barely above zero, even during the day. Lot of winds, lot of rain. It was fucking horrible, and it was pretty much like that for 3 weeks. And we flew in. I think we flew in, mate. We landed on the objective. I think it was would have been around the 12th of December, I think. And even from the get go, mate, on the first night, it was really gnarly. I thought this is going to be an interesting 3 weeks, because what happened is we landed on target about 2 in the morning. And the plan was to gain entry in this compound. We were going to get in, fill sandbags, get some defences up on the rooftops, and we were just going to sit tight until the morning. And then we were going to push out, sweeping through all the local sort of villages in the area. So we landed on mate about 2 o'clock in the morning, made way to our objective. We didn't know who or what was in the compound because obviously we don't have the intelligence assets at SF, do we? We don't have our luxury the way we're, you know yourself, but we go into a lot of things blind out there. So we used explosive method of entry, mate, on the compound wall, blew into the compound, went in, my section commander, Chris Harper, cleared the first room, managed to throw a flashbang into like a room full of fucking screaming women and kids. So I went down like a shit sandwich. Probably have to edit that, mate. So we took the compound. There was no there was no enemy forces on the compound. So we took the compound. You know how it was. We tell the civvies to piss off for a night or two because we're gonna live in their compound for a day or two. Anyway, pushed all the gunners and the snipers and everyone else up on the rooftops. Fill some sandbags up and all the rest of that good stuff that you do, mate. It must be an hour or two later, mate, about 3 o'clock in the morning. Most of the guys are getting their head down at this point, and you know, we got our sentries up. And one of the guys in my section, a guy called Dave Silcock, he's on stag behind the GPMG, and he's sort of whispering down, trying to get our attention to the lads that are sleeping next to the compound wall just below the rooftop. So he gets my attention, and I, you know, look up at him. I'm saying, what, you know, what's up, Dave? And he's like, there's a car approaching. So I quickly get my kit on. I get up on the rooftop with him. So me, Dave, the gunner, and one or two other lads up on the rooftop. Directly in front of our compound is the Nari Bugra Canal running like left to right in front of us. The other side of the canal is various compounds and dirt tracks. And there's this clapped out sedan, mate, coming down this dirt track, really slow, 5 miles an hour. Lights are off as well. And we're like, what the fuck's going on here? The only thing I can think, mate, is when we landed, obviously we made a bit of commotion because we landed in Chinooks, which are obviously noisy. We blew in through a compound wall with a bar, mate. There was flashbangs going off. So we made a hell of a noise. The only thing I can think of, mate, is it must have been some kind of Taliban sort of reconnaissance element trying to pinpoint our positions because they know we've landed, but maybe we didn't know where. I just thought maybe they were out trying to locate our positions. That's what I thought. And I think they massively fucked up because they found us. they literally popped up 20 meters away from us, but they still hadn't seen us on the roof of this compound. So it was one of those scenarios, mate, that you fucking dream of. It was just like figure 11 has just presented themselves, mate. And the doors flew open on this car, like literally probably a bit further than 20 meters away, probably no more than 50 meters away. The doors flew open on this car. Three geezers with AKs get out and start fucking milling about by the car. So it was almost like astonishment, mate. You know, like you like to think, like in that sort of scenario, you just automatically just let loose. But we, for a split second, we were sort of like looking at each other, like thinking, what the fuck? Like,
yeah, too good to be true.
Yeah, it was. And anyway, those three, we most of them got dropped by Dave, the GPMG gunner. We just dropped the three of them, mate. Shmooly went up as well. And we, you know, between myself and another few lads and Dave, the machine gunner, we managed to put them down. But that very much set the tone, mate, to be honest, for the rest of the operation. Because what we essentially did with Lima Company is we basically did a 60-kilometer advance to contact over that 3-week period. We cleared Nadi Ali from very south right to the north, and it was basically a 3-week, 60-kilometer advance to contact, mate. So that was the first night. You know, almost every day there was some form of scrapping, whether it be, you know, your sort of handbags, you sort of like shoot and scoop type things, or your more sort of concentrated 3-4 hour contacts. But I think one of the more notable ones was probably a few days later. We were in a sort of hamlet called Zargan-Calais. Zargan-Calais was a major sort of Taliban stronghold. And we basically received intelligence. There was a large Taliban presence in the town. And Lima Company with J Company also from 4-2 Commando assisting. There's army elements here, mate, as well. We had an omelette team, those Afghan idiots from the ANA. And they had advisors from One Rifles, I think. There was some PWRR there in Warriors. We basically got tasked to clear Zarg and Calais. And it turned into the biggest contact of the tour, I'd say. The first day was about 10 hours of fighting. And after 10 hours of fighting on the first day, we barely managed to get a foothold in the town. You know, this is sort of how determined they were. I remember we got to the outskirts of the town and we were being shot at by the usual assortment, mate, a PKM and an RPG. And we were in open cover. We were out in the open, mate. There was no cover. And I remember we were advancing towards the town and we had Vikings, you know, the Viking vehicles we used to use. We had a couple of Vikings with us. And I remember the Vikings were advancing across this open field and we were advancing on foot behind the Vikings, using them as cover with fucking 7.62 and RPG coming towards us. It was like something out of fucking World War II, mate. You know, like advancing across open ground, using the armour for cover. And I remember just looking at one of my mates next to me, Ben, and thinking, fuck me, we're in for a hell of a day here, mate. It didn't fucking disappoint either, to be honest.
So were you getting a lot of air support on that?
No, we weren't, mate, because the cloud cover was too low. So it was a two-day battle, basically. I think the first day was 10 hours. We did have a little bit of fast air on the first day because although the weather was bad, the cloud cover was quite high. There were a few 500-pounders and a few JDAMs dropped on the first day. But the second day, mate, the cloud ceiling was really low, so there was nothing at all. But the thing with Zarg and Calais is the Taliban, for whatever reason, they were obviously determined not to lose it because the main roads leading into the town, they got all the JCBs and they dug up the roads to stop like vehicles getting in and out. They'd use the same JCBs to dig like fire trenches. They literally had slit trenches in parts around the town. There was Taliban popping up in trenches maybe like 30 metres away from us. It was just absolutely fucking obscene. And yeah, I remember the first day, mate, it was just an absolute slugfest. It went on about 10 hours the first day. And it was the first time I remember being in contact with Taliban, other than the story I told you about earlier, when we landed. It's the first time I actually remember being in contact with Taliban where you could clearly see them, like dashing between compounds, you know, and popping up in fire trenches. And it was quite intense, mate, the first day at least, anyway. The second day, it was more of the same, mate, on the second day. Close quarters fighting, extremely, extremely poor weather. Just gradually just making our way through the town, mate. Like I said, the second day, we didn't have a luxury of air support, mate. So it was quite gritty, sort of like old school infantry fighting, mate, to you know, capture the objective, you know.
Do you have a mortar platoon or artillery or anything like that?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we did. We were lucky, obviously, wherever we go, we have 2-9 commando attached, and 2-9 commando, obviously, 3 commando brigades artillery element, and they're really good at what they do. So we had mortars, we had artillery. But yeah, I mean, it was still a tough fight, mate, even with those assets, you know, because you know yourself, those mud walls, they stop 30 mil from Apaches, mate. They are absolutely rock solid. So even with like things like mortars and artillery, mate, you know yourself, unless you're getting like direct hits, the effect is negligible, really. Do you know what I mean? It's not much you can do. So yeah, even though we did have it, it wasn't having like a terrible effect on the enemy, to be honest.
Are you taking casualties during this fighting?
Yeah, we did actually. We took quite a few. My GPMG gunner, Dave Silcock, the guy I told you about in the last story, the guy that wasted those three guys on the opening night, Dave was on the gun on the rooftop. I was on the rooftop next to him. I was feeding him link for the gun. All of a sudden, he starts screaming next to me that he's been hit. I thought, fuck me, here we go. And what happened is he got clipped by a round. The round had gone down his Osprey, down his body armor. The round had gone under his skin. And it basically traveled down pretty much the length of his back underneath his skin and came back out. So, I mean, so it didn't touch any bone. It didn't touch any, you know, major artery or organ. And he was screaming that he was hit. So we were in dire straits, mate, at this point, because like I said, the weather was terrible. It was sort of like ground fog down. It was pissing down. We were being engaged on this rooftop by about 4 or 5 different firing points as well. And because of the weather, our optics obviously weren't working great because we were all fucking wet and steamed up and everything else. And it's really hard to identify your firing points as well, because everything's wet. You know, sometimes you can identify firing points by like the blowback from the dust, from like the, you know, like the muzzle, you know, like the muzzle energy. You can sometimes ping the firing points from the dust that is blown from the muzzle energy. But because everything was soaking wet, you didn't have this luxury. So we couldn't see anything. Like, we couldn't see where these firing points were. We couldn't see where the enemy were. And we were just taking fire left, right, and center. Dave has obviously gone down. We're extracting him off the roof. I'm looking up at two of our guys extracting him, and I'm literally watching tracer rounds like ping in between them. And it wasn't long later, we had a scream of a man down from the opposite rooftop, and a guy called Fergie, he was attached to us as an MFC. Fergie's dead now, unfortunately. He passed away a few years ago in Thailand, I believe it was. But anyway, Fergie had he got hit in the leg with a tracer round. But the tracer round hadn't gone all the way through. So he was, poor guy, he was in a position where he was fucking screaming. It was blood-curdling screams where he had his tracer round stuck in his leg, just sizzling away, mate. You can imagine the pain he must have been in. So this happened to Fergie pretty much minutes later as well. So yeah, we were taking a fair few casualties, mate, almost exclusively from gunshot wounds. We had a blue-on-blue from the PWRR as well. They brass us up with a 30 mil cannon. Good blokes.
Talk us through that, mate.
It's a really funny story, believe it or not. So, well, my mate, I'm not going to mention it by name because he'll be very embarrassed, but on Herrick 5, he was fucking about with his pistol one day at Bastion, bored, managed to shoot himself through the hand of his pistol, right? His hand looked like a donut. So he got Kazovac from Herrick 5 before he'd even done anything. This is in the first few days. He went back to the unit, and he basically did about, he couldn't extend his fingers, mate. He had like a claw. You know, like the guy off Scary Movie, puts his hand in the mashed potato. He basically had like a little Jeremy Beadle hand going on, mate, for 8 months. Right. And he finally gets medically upgraded, mate, right? Just in time to go back on Herrick 9. I think he might have came out as a BCR. And basically this is his first, this op in Zargon Clay, this is his first taste of combat, mate, after being medically upgraded. So he's on the rooftop and he gets brassed up by the 30 mil from PWRR. So he literally does a swan dive off his compound roof, lands awkwardly on his shoulder, breaks his collarbone, gets Kazovac straight away.
Well, a proper pink mist kind of character.
Yeah. So basically, mate, yeah, so PWRR, whatever battalion, their armoured battalion was, they saw a bunch of guys up on the rooftop in British DPM in fighting order and SAEs and helmets, and decided they were Taliban. So they started brassing us up with 30 mil. The guys managed to get off the roof. Luckily, no one was hit, even though it was a close call. And we had one of our sergeants that was with us, Woody, in the middle of a battlefield, made middle of a contact with fucking tracer flying both ways everywhere. He literally strode up. I can't remember whether it was a warrior or a scimitar. It was one of them. But anyway, regardless, he sort of like strode up to this warrior or a scimitar, mate, in the middle of the contact. He knocked on the hatch. The hatch flew up. Some guy poked his head out from the PWRR. Woody just planged him, mate. Plopped him straight in the mouth, mate. He just punched him. And he came back, mate, with his fucking, you know, he came back like striding back, thinking he was Billy Big Bollocks, looking like he had two TVs under his arms, like really proud of himself. And we were like, Woody, you know, you just punched the driver, not the gunner. And he's like, what? Really? So he went and punched the PWRR guy, mate, in the middle of a contact. And it turned out he wasn't even the gunner. He probably had nothing to do with him.
Oh, poor lads just sat there, like, can't see nothing out of his ass. Like, yeah. No idea what's going on. He just gets punched in the face.
Probably like 19 years old, maybe 6 months out of training. Do you know what I mean? But yeah, to be honest, mate, yeah, I mean, Zargon Clay, it, like you say, to summarize, it was a 2-day battle. But 10 hours on the first day, 6 hours on the second day, but it was really sort of gritty, old-school infantry fighting, mate. You know, bad weather, close quarters, taking compounds, taking slit trenches, mate. It was really gnarly.
How did you get the casualties out? Where did they go, back to Bastion?
Yeah, so we had Viking with us, mate, in support. Like I said, we had a troop of Viking with us. So they arrived on station, and obviously they got GPMGs on top, so they balled up, mate, put a massive weight of fire down on the GPMGs on the Vikings, mate. We managed to get the guys loaded up, and I think they were Kazovac back to, I think it was called PBR Guile, if I remember rightly, which is a couple of kilometres away. So we were transporting me in Vikings back to PBR Gaol, and then the lifters, the chinooks came in and took them from there, mate.
As you were doing this advance of contact, was there units backfilling the areas that you'd cleared?
No, it wasn't me. No. So in essence, it was completely pointless, but it was good fun though. So
I'm sure it was, mate. It sounds good fun. But I'm just thinking now, I'm thinking, this is a lot of way to clear, this is a long way to clear an old, this is.
It was. I mean, the thing with the Hellman campaign from the British perspective is, until the USMC came and helped out, we just didn't have the numbers, mate. Like, the province was massive, and we just didn't have the numbers to take ground and the whole ground. So you know yourself, mate, with your experience out there, it was just like fucking whack-a-mole, mate. You go into an area, you get into savage contacts, you'd inflict massive casualties, you'd often sustain casualties yourselves, and the next day you'd move out and the Taliban would just move back in, and it just seemed like a pointless exercise. But like I said, it was fun, but it seemed a bit pointless.
Well, it's interesting as well that you're saying that while you were at Kandahar, you were covering four provinces, and it's kind of like, we can't even do one right.
No, I know, mate. Yeah, it's ridiculous, mate. But no, like I said, we did a 60, it was essentially a 60-kilometre advance of contact, mate, clearing village after village, after hamlet. And like I say, mate, there was no one backfilling us. And it sort of came to a conclusion, mate, on Christmas Eve, I would say, was one of the worst contacts we had. Certainly not the longest by any stretch, but definitely one of the more intense contacts. So I believe the town was called Kari Saheb Calais. The AO it was in would have been Nadi Ali North, I think. For anyone that's been in that AO, they'll remember it because it's got a big, massive crane in the sort of centre of the town. So we were scheduled to take Kari Saheb Calais, mate, on Christmas Eve. So our sort of modus operandi, what we would do is to sort of keep the element of surprise, is we would move at night, and then we would be in a line of departure on these villages the first light, and we would literally go in at first light, because the enemy weren't expecting us, mate. Like, not, British forces didn't generally move at night, so obviously they didn't see us. And when we turned up on their doorstep, mate, at dusk, ready to assault through their positions, they were completely taken aback. They were completely unaware a lot of the time. So this was a strategy we implemented throughout that tour, and it was something that worked well, and it enabled us to catch the Taliban with their pants down on more than one occasion. So this is something we did at Kari Saheb Calais. So my troop and my section actually was breaking section. So we obviously had to gain a foothold in the village, and the first objective was this little outhouse just on the edge, on the southern edge of the Kari Saheb Calais. So we went into this outhouse, mate, in a four-man stack. You know, when you're talking about room clearing, went in a four-man stack. My section commander, he was a good guy, actually, very inspirational. He always liked leading from the front, even though your point man or one of your Marines should be first through the door on paper. Chris would almost do it himself, which I thought personally was good leadership. Some would argue it's not. What happens if he's shot? He's a section commander. In the Marines, mate, we were blessed with really fucking high quality guys. So if a section commander did go down, the 2IC would step up and do just a good job, So we had that luxury a little bit. So I always thought it was good leadership, mate, to be honest. Anyway, regardless, Chris went in through the door. And it was still dark, so as we breached the doorway, we were using the torches on our LLMs, and we went in, and I was just outside the doorway. Stu and Chris, two of our guys, actually breached the doorway. I was right outside, and there's a load of screaming and shouting and commotion, and we're breaching the doorway, and there's a guy there with a fucking chess rig on, holding a Makarov pistol. So I don't know why, but Chris, for some reason or other, he tried to give the bloke a chance. He was screaming at him, drop the weapon. He had his SAD poised, like raised towards him with one hand, and his left hand was outstretched. And he was saying, give me a weapon. For some unknown reason, Chris tried to give him a chance, but this guy, he started raising the Makarov. So Chris shot him about six or seven times from literally 2 or 3 yards away. what we didn't see in the back of the room, because it was pitch black, in the back of the room, this Taliban fighter had his woman and kid in there. She was holding a baby. Some of the rounds had travelled through this Taliban. He turned out to be a Pakistani Taliban commander. Some of the rounds had travelled through this guy and had actually hit the baby in the abdomen. So, you know, we're like literally seconds into this clearance of this hamlet, and we're there, mate, fucking patching up a baby that had been shot, you know, no more than 6 months old. And again, I just had a feeling, mate, this was going to be one hell of a fucking day. And again, it didn't disappoint, mate, to be honest. Luckily, the baby was patched up, and we had word back from Bastion that it had actually pulled through, which is obviously good news. So that was obviously something that we were all really happy about. We continued then, mate, clearing compounds into the heart of this hamlet.
Just before we get to that, mate, in that initial reaction when he realised that he shot, that his rounds had hit a kid, how did that affect him in that moment?
Oh, he was gutted, mate. He was gutted. I mean, no, you know, despite of what liberal lefties and all the fucking media and all the rest of them tell you, we're not baby murderers. You know, we certainly don't go to these places looking to kill civilians. It's just not something we do in the British forces, mate. You know that yourself. So when civilian casualties do occur, particularly as a result of being caught in the crossfire, mate, it is quite gut-wrenching. I won't mention his surname, mate, but his name is Chris, and he was absolutely gutted. And I think it affected him quite deeply, mate. And the thing with Chris is, did you ever read the story about the Royal Marine sniper that had the world's highest amount of confirmed kills? He was like something like 170-odd, more than Chris Kyle. No. Well, that's Chris. Nice. That was my second commander. And I think the reason he gave this guy a chance, he wanted him to hand over the pistol and not just shoot him there and then, is because he's killed so many people over his career, mate, from sniping perspective. I genuinely think he just had enough of it, mate, and he wanted to give a guy a chance. That's all I can think of. Because if it was me, probably you, and any other guy, you know, mate, if it was, you know, the minute I went in there and saw a guy with a Makarov, then, you know, he's going down, mate. I'm not going to take any chances.
Yeah, I mean, how did it affect you personally in that moment?
It's one of those things, mate. It's like nothing can prepare you for those kind of images. I think on that particular day, we cleared through the hamlet a little bit, and it literally kicked off, mate, probably less than an hour later. So I don't think I really had time to process it, mate. I was back in contact pretty soon after, and you know, it just sort of took a back burner. But you know, when the dust settles a little bit, mate, and you have time to think about it, I think it does affect you a little bit. I think you've got to be pretty cold and callous, mate, not to be affected by those kind of things, mate, especially when it's women and kids, mate, as well. But I think the best part about it, mate, I think, was the fact that we had news come back from Bastion later in the day that the baby had pulled through. I think if it hadn't pulled through, mate, I think I probably would have felt, well, I know I would have felt a lot worse about it.
Was it the mother and the kids taken out? You got them out on a chunk, was it?
Yeah, we were, mate. Yeah, we called in a mert from Bastion, mate. And yeah, you're right, mate. Yeah, the mother and the baby were taken back to Bastion on the mert, mate. Yeah. But yeah, like I said, mate, the fact that the kid pulled through is, that's what made it not okay, but I think that's what made me manage it, you know?
I mean, there's a lot, like, we could go into there about someone coming from Pakistan and bringing his wife and kids with him along to the fight. What are you thinking?
There's no need to talk about Oldham or Rotherham today.
No. So I just want to clear up a couple of things about this hot mix. You mentioned the weather a few times. Was it just like pouring rain all the time, or was it just clammy, or what was like steaming at the sites and stuff?
Not so much steaming at the sites, but you know, like you're just getting constant rainwater on the site, on the ACOGs and everything. So because it's pissing down, you're trying to rub it off, and you know, you can't get like a really clear sight picture. So it was quite hard identifying firing points. But it was a 3 week off, mate. I mean, it wasn't like incessant. It wasn't pissing down with rain and you know, sideways wind every day. But large parts of it were. But this particular phase of the operation I'm talking about now on Christmas Eve, I remember it being a blue sky, sunny day. It was a nice day.
And when you were working in that rain and stuff, was the conditions underfoot like just like working in porridge?
Yeah, it was, mate. Yeah. Well, you know what it's like in Afghan on winter tours anyway, mate. You know that sort of dust, that moon dust, like when it becomes mixed with rainwater, it just turns into sludge, doesn't it? And you can go on like Google Images, mate, and you can type in like Operation Sonchara, and you'll see these images come up, mate, of 4-2 Commando in compounds, just, you know, up to their knees in mud, mate, basically. There's a guy on Instagram, mate, that posts just purely photos of British forces in action in Iraq.
Timo, is it?
Yeah.
Timo, I think off the top of my head, Timo 198, maybe?
Yeah. That's him, mate. Yeah. That's the guy I'm thinking of. He's posted some recently, actually, of this particular operation, mate, and it goes to great lengths to show the sort of conditions, mate, that the guys were operating in. But yeah, it was like a sob, mate, honestly. The mud, it was just terrible.
And what was it like for weeks living and operating in that? And like, did you get like, what kind of state was your body in at the end of that kind of operation?
I was absolutely fucked at the end of it, mate, to be honest. I'm not going to lie. I mean, you know, when you're yomping, mate, or tabbing, as they call it in the army, it's hard enough as it is, you know, never mind, you know, fighting 6, 8, 10 hour contacts in between. So, you know, we'd yomp for miles. We'd arrive on target. We might be in contact for 4 hours. We get our heads down. That night, we yomp off again. We might cover more miles again. Same again, mate. Get our heads down. Next morning, we'd be fighting again. And this sort of pattern, it just carried on for 3 weeks, mate. And like I say, at the end of it, mate, I'm not ashamed to admit, mate, I was just completely physically and emotionally as well fucking exhausted, mate. It was, as far as soldering goes, it was probably the hardest 3 weeks of my career, hands down. Yeah, but I think, like, talking about the conditions, mate, like, we were lucky in a sense, because obviously Royal Marines are Britain's Arctic and mountain warfare specialists, so, you know, we spend a lot of time training in Scotland, a lot of time training in Norway. So, you know, living in wet, cold, miserable conditions is something that the guys were just used to, you know. So it was tough, but, you know, it didn't dampen anyone's spirits. It's just business as usual, really, for those guys.
Was it too much for anybody? Was anybody, either the strain of the fighting or the strain of the living conditions, did anyone buckle under it?
Nah, never. Yeah, not from what I was told, mate, nah.
Just for the listeners, he gave me a steely gaze when he said that then. That was a steely gaze, mate.
Yeah, but you know, I'm obviously really proud of my service in the Marines, mate. The quality of bloke is extremely high level. You know, they're above average intelligence. They're extremely fit, extremely robust, extremely professional. I never saw anyone buckle out there, mate. They were just fucking really, really, really great guys, mate.
No, fair play, mate. I mean, that, I think, is testament to the training that the Marines go through. You know, I mean,
yeah,
it's going to weed out a lot of people that would not be able to sustain those kind of operations, that kind of environment. One thing I meant to ask you, mate, because you covered 60 kilometres.
Yeah.
What was the kind of IED threat like, and how were you going about, like, the route selection, that kind of thing?
Well, we were lucky on Heret Night, mate, because, like I say, we weren't permanently based in patrol bases in places like Sangin and Gajaki, because we were carrying out strike op in areas that hadn't been sort of like inhabited by ISAF forces in the past. There hadn't been any sort of like pattern set, you know, like patrol patterns. So because these areas, mate, they were top heavy with Taliban, there was no ISAF forces there. There'd never been any ISAF forces there. So it was always hard for the Taliban to place IEDs because, you know, like I say, no patterns have been set. So we were just navigating the battle space, mate, completely freely, to be honest. Like Heret 9, obviously we had Valens on Heret 9 for IED detection, but I think the whole of a 6-month tour, mate, I think I saw a Valen being used like once. So it was a fucking dream.
Yeah. That's awesome, mate. All right, mate. So you got back. Got back off our tour 2009. You went back out in 2011 with 4-2 Commando again. What was your kind of role on that one?
So I got back off that tour, mate. I was a Lance Corporal on Heret 9. Got back off that tour and I did my junior command course and my skill at arms. And then, yeah, went back again on Heret 14, summer tour. in 2011. So obviously by now I was a corporal and a section commander on Heron 14. We were based in Nari Saraj South for this tour. Just back in the usual sort of routine, mate, just back in a static PB in Helmand.
Right, so the good old days of flying around the Chinooks, no IEDs were over.
They were over, mate, and we were fucking brought crashing back down to reality, mate, on this tour, yeah.
So,
buckle up.
What you in? Were you in like a company location or like a platoon kind of housing? Or?
Yeah, so we started off, mate. We were in a company location. It was called PB Folad. So we're in PB Folad as a company complete. But there was a little bit of a reshuffle sort of like a couple of weeks into the tour. And then we were just fucking scattered everywhere then, mate. The patrol bases that we were responsible for were all pretty kinetic as well, really. We had CP Toki, which was described as the most IED'd square mile on Earth at the time in the media. So that was a nice place. PB Selang and CP Zarawar.
Right. So when you started off in the company location, were you able to go out as ops on a company and actually kind of get out and kind of do some company ops? And then what happened as you started to get spread out?
Yeah, pretty much, mate. Yeah, like I said, when we were at PB Folad, we were a company complete. So like you say, yeah, we could do some company-sized ops, and we did as well, because, you know, we would just leave like a skeleton crew behind, so you'd have all the sort of like attached ranks, like chefs and the drivers and everyone else that would man the sangers, and the guys would go out. So I think we managed to do like two sort of company-sized air assaults in various areas of Helmand. And after those, mate, we got like scattered all over the place, to be honest, into sort of like more troop platoon sized locations, you know.
Yeah, you're coloured in someone's map, mate, basically. It's like, oh, look at all these different positions that we're holding.
Yeah, pretty much, mate. Yeah.
What was that like living in those kind of small locations?
Austere, mate. Austere.
That's a big word.
Yeah, it's for bootneck, mate. Yeah. Yeah, it was, mate. I mean, I was at CP Toki. CP Toki was actually the sort of focus of the Chris Terrell documentary. It was on Channel 5, mate, going back years ago now. It was called Royal Marines Mission Afghanistan. It gives a good picture of what CP Toki was like, mate. It was in the media, mate, at the time for being, like I said, the most IED square mile on Earth, I think the media were calling it. And it was exactly what I said on the tin, mate, to be honest. It was like IED ring after IED ring after IED ring around the CP itself. But as far as the living conditions went inside, we didn't have any creature comforts at all, mate. We were living on, you know, cot beds, you know, with the mosquito nets, with just like a poncho, like a basher over the top, out in the open air on the HLS, as it was. I think we had a couple of diesel generators for, you know, charging bits and bobs. And that was it, mate. Like, we didn't have a pot to piss in. Like, no internet. You know,
let me ask you that. Where did you go to the bathroom?
What did we have? I think we had, like pits, mate. I think we had, like, pits, as far as I remember. Like, literally pits dug in the ground by the engineers.
Did you have one of those piss tubes?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we had the piss tubes. Yeah. Mate, it's so long ago. I'm trying to remember what the shitting situation was. I'm sure it was, like, pits or something, yeah. Mate, it was fucking grim, mate. It was absolutely grim. Like, we didn't even have any shipping containers on this CP, mate. It was nothing, mate. It was a compound, like an Afghan compound. So 90% of the perimeter was just, you know, your Afghan walls that you have on Afghan compounds. And they just have a little bit of Hexco Bastion in the corners of the compound that formed, like, the sangers, inverted commas. But most oppositions, mate, were just, like, sandbag positions on the rooftops. And yeah, it was grim, mate. It was grim. I mean, it would have been all right if you were staying there a week or two, but, you know, guys are staying the most of the tour. It was fucking, God, it was grim. It was worse than Heron 5. You think, like, living conditions would gradually improve over the tours, but fucking hell, mate, I was living way more comfortably on Heron 5 than I was on Heron 14.
How many of you were in this place?
I think we must have had, like, a troop size element from L Company, from 4-2. And then we had, I think we had two multiples of jocks, mate. So I think one of the jock multiples was infantry. And I think one of the jock multiples was like some kind of like jock cavalry or something, if I remember rightly. But the jock infantry were fucking rubbish. But the jock cavalry were mega, which surprised me.
All right. So how would it work then for actually kind of getting out? What were you kind of doing in terms of patrols and that kind of thing?
Mate, you know, you were going on about Heret 9, about us not using Valens and having no IED threat. Like I say, you come crashing back to reality on it, Tommy, because, you know, on Heret 9, we would go out on a you know, a two-hour patrol, and you might cover 4, 5, 6 kilometres. Like, at Toki, we would go out on a two-hour patrol. You're lucky if you covered 200 metres, mate. It was just the ground around the area, mate, just lended itself perfectly to IEDs. It was just choke point after choke point and VPs, vulnerable points and vulnerable areas everywhere. So, you know, you constantly had the Valen out, mate. You remember the horn, the sort of ground detecting radar thing? Do you ever use a horn?
Never had that, mate. That was before, after my time, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, it looks like a Valen, mate, but it's got like a thicker head on it. And it's just like a ground penetrating radar and can find IEDs. So we constantly had the Valen out, mate. We constantly had the horn out. And to be honest, from a small arms perspective, mate, Togi wasn't like incredibly kinetic. It was just IEDs everywhere. It wasn't until later on in the tour, until I went to another PB called Selang. And then when we started doing some more sort of like helo-borne ops later on in the tour, things got kinetic. So we were taking quite a lot of casualties at Togi, but it was frustrating, mate. We were taking quite a lot of casualties, but we weren't seeing the enemy. It was just all fucking IEDs.
So what was the casualties you were getting then? Did you have any from your section?
I was really lucky, mate, because so I was a section commander, and I think my section was the only section in the company that didn't have any casualties on that tour. I don't think like that's a reflection on me or my ability or anything like that. I'm not suggesting it is. I honestly think it's just fucking luck of the draw, mate, because you know how it is out there. You can be the best soldier in the world, mate, but when your time's up, your time is up. And I remember a good example of that would be when we did a joint patrol with 4-5 Commando. We took over PB Selang from 4-5. So 4-2 Commando and 4-5 Commando did a joint patrol. 4-5 took us out on a familiar patrol, and it was led by a guy called Spider. He was a section commander. And I was sat in his orders, mate, his sort of like QBOs, his quick battle orders before we went out and did this patrol. And I remember looking at him, mate, thinking, fucking hell, this guy's really swept up. He knows what he's doing. His, you know, orders was superb, really professional, knew what he was talking about. Went out on the ground, mate. 10 minutes later, he steps on an IED in the middle of the field. You know, no, it wasn't a choke point, it wasn't a vulnerable point, wasn't a vulnerable area. Just literally stood on an IED, mate, in the middle of the field, two legs and his arm gone. And, you know, that's what I mean, mate. It was just like a draw, wasn't it? You could be the best section commander in the world, but when your time is up, your time is up, mate.
When you were in that location, the checkpoint, were you, like, the casualties you were getting then, was it traumatic amputations, deaths? What were the kind of casualties you're getting from them?
Yeah, mate. I think Lima Company on that tour, casualty rate was through the bloody roof, mate. We had like 25% casualties on that tour. We only had a small company anyway. We had 80-ish guys. And I think we had about 25 casualties all in all. It was about 25% casualties, mate. Pretty much all of them were blast injuries from IEDs. We had one guy, Marty, it was in 8 Troop, but suffered a gunshot wound to the collarbone. 8 Troop on patrol in the green zone. Marty was point man, and pretty much Marty's point man bumped into a Taliban patrol's point man in a cornfield. Yeah, you know, the cornfields that are about 10 foot high. So our point man bumped into their point man in this cornfield, mate, and it was like gunfight at the OK Corral for 8 Troop, mate. They were digging in with their eyelids, mate, like in a contact like 5 meters away from the Taliban. So Marty took one through the collarbone. I think he ended up getting medically discharged for it in the end. But yeah, 99% were blast injuries, mate. And we were so lucky because in RAO, we think there was a barred batch of homemade explosives that was going into these IEDs, because blokes were stepping on IEDs that were 20 kilogram charges. So by right, so he should have been ping missed. But guys were getting away with like bruised ankles or losing a foot, you know? So these IEDs in RAO, a lot of them weren't detonating properly. So we lost one guy KIA through an IED, a guy called Dino Mead. But yeah, the majority of these IEDs in RAO, mate, we were so fucking lucky because we should have had so many more KIA. But because the HME was dodgy, they were using, we were getting away with it, basically.
You'd have been gutted if SF came in and took out that bomb maker.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, we would have, mate. Yeah, we would have.
Should they just found out who he was? Kept sending him to take what? I will do this.
Yeah. Well, but mate, I remember, I tell you one story. We got us one day with like an improvised claymore, you know, like a directional fragmentation charge. So what we did was they cut an oil drum in half and they filled the bottom half with plastic explosives and they filled the top half with nuts, bolts, nails, all the usual shit. And they dug out the back of a wall, mate. So the wall was like wafer thin, you know, from the front. Put it in the wall, and this wall was sort of like shoulder high. So we waited for our guys to patrol past the wall because they could see, you know, they could see the guys because it was only shoulder high. When all the guys, or about six of the guys, were adjacent to the wall, it was on command pull. So we triggered it, and it you know, they basically caused a mass casualty incident within our troop. Maybe we took out six of our guys with an improvised claymore, basically.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you start to get used to looking around your feet and then you realise that you've got looking walls, you've got looking trees, you know, fucking yeah. Anywhere. And what was it, actually, were you in the green zone where this PP was, or checkpoint?
Yeah, we were, mate. Yeah, I mean, PB Folad and PB Salang were both on the edge of the green zone. CP Zarawar and CP Toki, they were both quite deep in the green zone on this tour.
And you were working with the ANA on this tour as well?
Yeah, we worked with the ANA. It's PB Salang, mate, unfortunately. Mate, just the usual stories. It's fucking useless, bone idle cunts, weren't they? You know, just didn't want to do anything, mate. I mean, we would, we had a model outside our ops room of RAO. So we would get the Afghan army commander to come round in the evenings and we would just go over patrol orders for the next day. And he'd be there with his notebook, mate, you know, looking mega keen, like taking notes and nodding along to the orders and all the rest of it. And we tell him timings for the next morning, saying, right, we want your guys at the front gate. We're going to step off in 0600. Yes, sir. You know, he's nodding. 0600 would come, mate. There's no sign of him. So we send one of our guys up to go to their accommodation. We're all still in their fucking, in their sleeping bags, mate. So one of our guys is screaming and shouting, get up, we're meant to be on patrol now. He come back to the front gate, another 10 minutes passes, goes back, is still asleep. By this time, he's literally tipping them out of their beds. He's like upending their cot beds. Get your fucking kit on, we're on patrol. We go back down. By now, mate, it's 6:30. We send them up a third time to go and get them. And they're just milling about, smoking and everything, mate. We just couldn't get them on patrol. There have been a few instances before where they've been creeping around our tents at night and stealing NVGs and, you know, stealing like thermal imaging sites. We'd had one or two Mexican standoffs with them, mate, where you know, weapons are pointed at each other. In the end, mate, like our relationship with the ANA just deteriorated so badly that we got 5-9 Commando, our engineers, to make a separate camp, like, you know, 50 meters down the road from our PB. We just fucked them off, mate. We just got to live there. We just didn't want them anywhere near us in the end.
Mate, yeah, the ANA experience of the hit and miss, I mean, some people, you know, swear by them. But, I mean, it seems to be like a massive drop-off between the commandos. I've heard stories about them just being gleaming.
Yeah.
And then like, my experience, a lot of other people's experience, same as yours, like the kind of regular line units, just be like, yeah, just not asked, turn up when they want, try and get off operations early. Fucking just, yeah, bit of a mess. But what were they like when they got into contact?
Just useless, mate. I mean, exactly like you said then, guys. I mean, the Afghan Tiger teams that used to work with that were mentored by SLSG and the Afghan Commandos that were sort of mentored by more like Tier 1 units, they were really good. Like, they had really good reputations. They got really good results on the ground. And they were quite well respected by, you know, their sort of ISAF partners. But Yeah, like you say, mate, we were just working with like regular Afghan army infantry battalions, mate. And more often than not, they'd be fucking AWOL. The ones that were with us, they didn't want to work. When it did kick off, mate, you had two types of Afghan army soldier. You'd have the one that was absolutely off his tits on heroin in the middle of a firefight, that would just be spraying his M16 from the hip in the middle of a field. Or you would have the one just, you know, just led down in a ditch, staying out of a line of fire because he can't be arsed. There was no sort of in between, mate. And it was quite demoralizing, mate, to be honest, in a sense, because like we're out there trying to help them, trying to build their nation. And we're fighting and dying and losing friends in the process. And these guys couldn't give a solitary fuck. Like, we didn't care. It disillusioned a lot of blokes, mate, because I think like many of us thought, like, you know, if they don't care, then why the fuck should we care? And that's how I felt towards the end, mate, to be honest. Totally.
Did it matter that you cared, or would you have wanted to be there anyway?
Mate, do you know what? I thought about this quite often, and I think like the older I get, I think the more sort of like liberal I've got. I mean, when I joined the military, mate, I was 16 and I was naive. And we were sort of fed this narrative that we're going into Iraq and when we're going into Afghanistan to fight these people in Baghdad and Kabul so we don't have to fight them in Birmingham and Cardiff. And it's like, when you're 18, you might swallow it, mate. But looking back now, it's the biggest fucking crock of shit I've ever heard in my life. And no one can tell me otherwise, mate.
These people who don't even know what the next province is somehow going to find their way to Birmingham.
Exactly, mate.
I was going to say, mate, I think we had our last guest on, and I've heard this off quite a few people. They work with people who didn't even know 9/11 happened.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, what was 9/11?
Mate, it's staggering, mate. And, you know, the thing with Iraq especially, like, you know, I never served in Iraq personally, but, you know, we went to Iraq on the sort of pretense of there being weapons of mass destruction. And, you know, Saddam was going to, you know, somehow strike America, and Saddam was linked to Al-Qaeda, and Saddam was linked to 9/11. And it was all bullshit, mate. And, you know, looking into Afghanistan as well, like, the Taliban have never had ambitions outside of Afghanistan. They've never launched terrorist attacks in America. They've never launched terrorist attacks in Europe or the UK. They never had the intent. But, you know, somehow we're going to be running amok in Washington or London, and we have to go to the fucking hell, man, to fight guys with AKs and flip-flops to save the world. And it's just, if you believe it, I think you're a fucking retard. But I mean, you know, I don't want to come across as a complete sort of socialist, but I mean,
I wouldn't say socialist, mate. I mean, it's just you're talking from the experience, like.
Yeah I mean, the thing is, I'm a little bit hypocritical as well. It's like, do I think we should have been in the first place? No, not really. Do I think we achieved anything when we were there? Probably not. Would I do it all again? Fucking absolutely I would. Because it was good fun.
Right. And I think, like, you've got to kind of look at that. I've always thought, this is where the problem is, unfortunately. If it could just be two groups of blokes having a scrap on a field, then I kind of say it's the same as two people that ask to get in a MMA ring, right? But can you imagine if there's an MMA fight and then a baby gets thrown in the middle of the fight? And has to fight, right? That's where the bit of a, I'm a bit of a piece of shit for wanting this, kind of creeps in. Because if there's a baby getting punted around the MMA rig, you'd say this isn't on. But but it doesn't mean you don't want to do MMA.
No, exactly. Yeah.
And like, you know, we're not going to kind of go into all of this and stuff about now, but I just think generally speaking, I think that's where we have that dichotomy as veterans is like, yeah, I enjoyed what I did. But you know, the fucking civvy that was living in the village wasn't enjoying it, you know? And the thing is, the Taliban might have been enjoying it too.
They probably were. They probably would have been similar to us, mate, in a lot of senses with regards to combat. They probably would have buzzed off it as well, I think, you know?
So there's that, mate. And like, you know, I'm not saying all the Taliban. I'm sure some of them were probably, I mean, obviously there was the $10 Taliban and stuff. And I'm sure a lot of them had the option of go and plant this IED or get shot in the face. And you're going to go and plant the IED, aren't you? But I mean, I do always tell you this, like, and I'm sure you're probably the same way, mate. You get people like, oh, our brave troops shouldn't. And it's like, look, we all volunteered.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. No one was press gang, mate. You know, no one was forced into it. Everyone was there as a volunteer. And Yeah, that's absolutely right, mate. And I think, like, what one thing that I don't like, you know, since the, you know, the global war on terror and the commas is like this sort of like sense of veteran entitlement, you know, this sense that like, you know, you've done one tour of Iraq or you've done one tour of Afghanistan and like the world owes you a fucking living all of a sudden. It's like, you know, we all made our own choices, mate. And like you just said correctly, Engez, no one forced us into it. We weren't press ganged. We weren't conscripted. We went as volunteers of our own free will, mate, at the end of the day. So you've got to be prepared to handle the consequences, mate, you know, whatever they are.
Especially if you've got multiple tours.
Especially if you've got multiple tours, mate. I went on back-to-back tours of Herrick, and I'm not special, mate. Many of our generation did. And I enjoyed it, mate. And, you know, I fortunately, you know, I came back mentally and physically unscathed, but I've never had this feeling that the fucking world owes me a living because of what I've done. I don't want any special treatment or recognition, you know. It was just a job to me, mate. And I think it was to a lot of my former colleagues as well. It was just a job that I enjoyed as well, you know. But yeah, strange times, mate.
So, mate, is there anything else that I maybe missed that you think and think of that you want to bring up?
Yeah, I mean, we were telling the story about DFC with their actual fragmentation charge earlier. It was quite a story. It was another Hilo assault we did from Bastion. The aim was RCP, CP Zarawar, was getting hit regularly by small arms. A lot of our patrols were getting contacted by small arms, and yeah, they were in the thick of it most days. And sort of intelligence that we gained from, we were fortunate enough to get intelligence from higher assets on this occasion. And the intelligence that we gained was it was a sort of large Taliban force that was located about 2 or 3 kilometers south of CP Zarawar. And this was a sort of like rear area, like their bed down locations. They were using it for like medical and logistical purposes and storage and all the rest of it. And they were coming up from the south in the rear area, and they were sort of attacking Zarawar, CP itself, and our patrols at will. And then they were melting back away down to their rear areas again. So company commander wanted to launch a Hilo assault, where the intent was basically just to drop kick a fucking hornet's nest. So we landed in this area, mate, just on the edge of these sort of bed down locations again in Chinooks about 2 o'clock in the morning. We took over a compound. We asked the family to leave because we were going to occupy this compound for the next 3 days. And we did the usual, mate. Throughout the night, we were filling sandbags, you know, fortifying our positions on the rooftops. And guys like myself had done one or two Herricks before, knew full well, really, as soon as the sun came up, probably going to go bananas, and it did. So, yeah, as soon as first light came on the first day of assault, mate, we were getting it from all angles. We were getting RPGs. We were getting a lot of UGLs as well, the end-of-swing grenade launchers. Because on Herrick 14, the Afghan police had been issued under-swing grenade launchers. Funnily enough, all the Afghan police grenade launchers go missing. And then every time we're on patrol, we're getting a lot of UGL fire. So, you know, no prizes guessing where they ended up. Made not only AMP, but you were probably moonlighting. You were probably like AMP at night and fucking Taliban during the day. But anyway, mate, we were in a sort of situation, mate, where we were pinned down in this compound. We'd been attacked from 3 or 4 sides. And one day a UGL lands in the compound. So the UGL landed in the compound and it took out 6 of our guys. We had 6 guys with us attached to us from M Company in 4-2 Commando. Yeah, I think it was 6 guys that were Kazovac, mate, by Pedro, because the LS was so hot because contact was ongoing. And obviously, Pedro has one Black Hawk circling, doesn't it, with a minigun providing suppression whilst the second Hilo lands. So, yeah, we got 6 guys on the Pedro, mate, and they were Kazovac. So obviously, our sort of manpower is probably reduced by 30% now. And we're still in the thick of it, being assaulted probably 6 or 7 times a day. So, you know, the troop commander made a decision that we can't just hold firm in this compound and absorb everything. We've got to push out and show a bit of presence on the ground and try and push the flat, you know, forward line enemy troops back a little bit. So the next day we pushed out on patrol. And like I said, they put this fucking directional fragmentation charge, mate, essentially this improvised claymore in this wall. It was command wire IED as well. And they, like I said, they just waited until six of our guys were lined up along this wall, clapped it off. And again, mate, we had our second mass casualty situation in 2 days. So we've taken 12 wounded in action, mate, in 2 days. So we're in dire straits now. Because of a manpower issue now, we're essentially combat ineffective. We can't really do anything with the numbers we have left. We couldn't get resupply in from the Chinooks because the area is too hot. So everyone's running out of food. We're running out of water. We're running out of ammunition. And we're dealing with our second mass cash incident in 2 days. Things are starting to take a really fucking grim turn, to be honest, mate. When the IED exploded, I was leading the other multiple. Vicey, one of my best mates, Paul Vice, was leading multiple that was blown up. So you had this massive explosion, and by the mushroom cloud that went in the air straight away, I could see it was an IED. I was probably like 100 metres to the south in a cornfield. So my multiple started making our way towards them. And when we got there, when we arrived on the scene, it was absolute carnage, to be honest, mate. I think we had two Cat A casualties, two Cat B and the rest of Cat C. But Vicey had taken 300 individual shrapnel wounds to one side of his body. Obviously, we didn't know it was 300 at the time. I came out later. But he'd taken 300 shrapnel wounds, mate, all to his one side. One of the pieces of shrapnel had severed the carotid artery in his neck. So he was bleeding out of his artery in his neck. And Richie Pencott, one of our guys, had to get the Vicey quickly. And he literally stuck his knee in his neck to stop the bleeding. So Vicey died on the scene. But I think one of our medics, Leanne, she's a Royal Navy medic. She, I think, as far as I remember, Leanne managed to bring him back with CPR. So brought him back to life. He got put on a MERT and he flatlined again. And they managed to bring him back again. And he's alive and well now, obviously.
Oh my God, mate. That's mental.
Yeah, it was really bad, mate. Luke, one of the other guys, took a piece of shrapnel through his helmet and through his brain. And I was treating him, mate. He was a casualty. I was treating. And it's like, you know, there was no real blood. He wasn't losing any blood. His airways were clear. He was talking to me, so he was clearly breathing. His circulation was fine. You go through all these processes that you're taught. So I didn't really know what to do, mate. So I just stuck my hand down his pants, not being gay. I just had a good rummage around and had a feel for his cock and balls. And I was like, Luke, everything's intact, mate.
You've been waiting for that moment for three tours.
I've been waiting for years, mate. Yeah, any excuse. But I thought I'd just make a joke of it, mate, because I didn't really know what else to do, because, you know, he was stable and he was talking, but he just had a piece of shrapnel like lodged in his brain. He's around as well, mate. But by the time we got those casualties out, we were left with a skeleton crew back in this compound. And we were essentially just stuck in there, mate. We couldn't patrol out because we were probably had about 10, 11 guys left. We were down to less than 50% manpower. And I think the Taliban smelt blood, mate, because the next sort of day or two, they really went for a jugular, and they were trying to overrun the compound, basically. It turned into like a mini Rorke's Drift, into like a FOB defense serial. And there was a lot of nighttime contacts as well, which is quite rare for Hellman, fighting going on at night. So as you can imagine, mate, you know, the Shamoulis going up, there's artillery and mortar, a loom going down, and red tracer going out, green tracer coming back in, and it was like fucking Star Wars, mate. And that went on for the next 2 days. In the end, we managed to extract out of it and the cover of darkness on the last day. But yeah, that was a pretty gnarly couple of days.
Anyone get hit in the small arms fire?
No, we didn't, mate. Actually, all the count, even though it was. You know, a lot of small arms flying around. All the casualties were just blasts, mate, from the UGL, like I said, and from the IED. But I think collectively, we were there in troop strength initially, and we got out of there with like half a troop that made it out in one piece. But I think collectively, I think we had about 30 enemy KIA, which is pretty insane, really, for the amount of us that were there. A lot of those were sort of claimed by the snipers, to be honest. But yeah, really gnarly few days, mate. And those kind of operations, mate, where, you know, you have a Taliban sort of trying to overrun your position. It was a little bit weird seeing it on that later kind of tour on Herat 14. That was usually like the kind of tactics that were like the hallmark of, you know, like the early Herats, Herat 5, Herat 6, definitely Herat 4. So yeah, it was interesting to see, mate.
You mentioned going back to the site.
Yeah, shit, yeah, I forgot to mention this. But yeah, so, well reminded, actually. This is a crazy story as well. Yeah, so the guys got blown up by the IED. We managed to get the guys' Kazovac on the Mert, and we patrolled back to the compound that we were working from, and one of the guys, he was in the compound. One of the guys said to this guy was what we call a rubber dagger. He's a Royal Marine Reserve. Right, so he's a part-timer. So one of my guys said to him, he said, "Hey, hang on, didn't you have ECM on when you went out on the ground?" And he brought his hands up to feel for shoulder straps, and his face just dropped.
Oh my God! Right, and we're gonna have to take a minute just tell, because obviously some people listening don't understand what ECM is and the importance of ECM. So can you just fill them in?
Of course. Yeah, so ECM stands for electronic countermeasures, and it comes in a few forms. Basically, look like radio sets that are carried, shoulder carried in a backpack by troops on the ground. And their job is massively, massively important because they send out radio signals that block IEDs. They block transmissions from radios, mobile phones, key fobs that can trigger IEDs. You really don't want these falling into enemy hands because they can obviously be reverse engineered. So it's a bit of a big no-no losing a set of fucking ECM. So yeah, so mate, he started feeling his shoulder straps, and then his face just dropped. And mate, anyone that's ever worked with me, mate, worked under me, has been one of my guys in my section, will always tell you I've always been like really, really chilled, really softly spoken. I'm not a flasher. I've never been a screamer or a shouter, but I made an exception this time. I had all of this cunt, mate, by his fucking chin strap. Like, I lifted it up on his fucking tiptoes, mate. I literally said to him, I said, me and my guys are going back out to get your ECM. I said, if anything fucking happens to us, I'll come back and I'll fucking shoot you myself. Bearing in mind, this guy, the day before, he had an ND in the compound. He had an ND in the compound. The bullet, the round, went through the compound roof, landed in the room below, where a load of Royal Engineers are attached to us, cleaning their weapons. Literally missed someone's leg by about 2 foot. So he had an ND the day before. He's lost his ECM today. Yeah, like I said, I just had all of him by his chin strap, but threatened to shoot him myself if anything happened to my blokes when we went back out on the ground. So he must have shit himself, mate, because I took my blokes back out on the ground to get his ECM. 2 minutes later, all he could hear was fucking gunshots and grenades going on. So, mate, we went back out to pick his ECM up. An ECM was obviously left on the scene of the explosion, which was only about 50 meters away from our compound. So I went out. We're walking. I only took four guys because it's only 50 meters away. So we're in staggered file moving down this track. And this track has got a prominent bend in it, like halfway towards the explosion site. So when me and my point man come round the corner, we just see a load of blokes, three blokes, holding up, you know, FFDs, like our FFDs that were covered in blood, bandages covered in blood. They were holding up like shreds of probably Vicey's trousers that were covered in blood. And they were holding all this kit of ours covered in blood, and they were like dancing a little jig in the middle of the park, really happy with themselves. And then they saw us literally by this point, 10 meters away. And basically, mate, that me and my team just rinsed the three of them, mate, from short range. I think Jake Bargan, the guy with point man, with shotgun dropped one. Strangely, I remember one. There's a low wall, like a waist-height wall, like adjacent to the scene. I remember one just like popped up like a figure 11 target, mate. Easier to shoot it. And he just popped up like a figure 11. And I remember instinctively, mate, just raising my rifle and dropping him from about probably about 5 meters away. And I think the last remaining one, he ran into like this little alcove, mate, right? It was like a little alcove between two compounds further along the track. And he hid in there. So for him to come back out, he would have had to expose himself to us again, where we'd obviously drop him. And my guys were all for pushing down towards him further and just popping the corner and shooting him. But because of what happened, as a section commander, in the back of my mind, I was thinking secondary devices. So I said to the guys, I don't really want to push beyond that point because it could be secondaries waiting for us. And because of a manpower situation back at our compound, mate, with what happened in the previous 2 days, I thought, you know what? This guy's had a fucking touch today. We'll let him go. But one of my guys that was with me, Matty, he's SBS now. He's been badged SBS for quite a few years now. He insists that he could get a hand grenade in this sort of like alcove from where he was. And I was like, all right, fucking go for it. He's like a big time cricketer in South Africa before he joined the Corps. So he launched his grenade. I've never seen anyone launch a grenade so far. And it landed a little bit short. So it wouldn't have done him any damage. So I was like, right, I'll do. Come on, let's go. So we picked the ECM up and we were about to go. And Matt, he's like, no, you know what? Like, brew, I could do it. So he sort of twisted my arm. I was like, right, fuck, all right, one more. So, mate, he threw this grenade about 50 meters, mate. I just watched it sail through the air and it just would have landed like right on top of his kind of position. And it was just perfect, mate. So, you know, we didn't see a body as per se, but there's no way he was getting out of it alive, mate. So that was pretty sweet, you know, them blowing our friends up and then us coming face to face with them when they were idiotic enough to do a BDA, a battle damage assessment, like literally 5 minutes later.
Fortunes of war, that, mate. 1 minute,
yeah.
Top of the world. Next minute, fucking smoked.
Yeah, it is, mate. It's fine lines, mate. Fine lines.
Well, bro, thanks for coming on today, mate. I really enjoyed this. Some good war dits, mate. Been a long time coming, bro. We'll have to do another kind of podcast one day, mate. When you change the line of work now, and we
can
have a full send, mate. But yeah, thanks for coming on, bro. Hopefully, catch up with you in person soon, mate, and have a scoop.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for having me on, guys. Appreciate it, mate.
Cheers, mate. Ta-ra, bro.
Cheers, mate. Nice one.
Guys, thanks for listening to today's podcast. Ben, thanks for being a great guest. Thanks for sharing your stories. If you want to support the podcast, then you can do by telling a friend, text a friend about it, text the link. All these apps that you listen to have got little share buttons. If you could use those share buttons or use that share hole in the middle of your mouth, then that would be great as well. Let people know about the podcast, guys. And if you are a supporter of the podcast on the Patreon, we appreciate it very, very much. Thanks for everybody that's doing that. Helps keeps the lights on in the podcast, helps keeps us going. And a couple more podcasts. We're back in here recording in a couple of days. Got a couple more guests lined up for you. Like I said, we'll be moving away from Afghanistan for a few episodes now. I know it's where a lot of us have been. I know it's got a big place in our heart, but so. We got a few of those coming up as well. And as I said at the beginning, guys, if you know anybody that you think would be interested in being a guest, then ask them. And if they are, get in touch with us. And if you're someone that served in a war zone yourself and would like to come on the podcast, then get in touch. And you can do all that link down in the show notes. All right, guys, until then, we'll catch you next time and we'll love you. Bye.